coronavirus cases surged among 18 to 22-year-olds in August as many colleges reopened, with the Northeast witnessing the largest increase. Historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, have reported lower infection rates and generally higher compliance with social distancing and public health rules compared with predominantly white institutions, according to a new analysis by Inside Higher Ed. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said they are hopeful they can reach a deal for a new economic stimulus. The Treasury Secretary says we're going to give it one more serious try. The Speaker has told Democrats a vote on the stimulus bill will come today if there is no deal. Trump touted new rapid coronavirus tests as game changers, but state leaders say the rollout at nursing homes has been plagued by poor communication, false results, and inadequate planning. Tennessee removes all restrictions on businesses and large gatherings. The NFL faced its first outbreak of the season on Tuesday as 8 players and personnel for the Tennessee Titans tested positive for the coronavirus. Sunday's Steelers-Titans game becomes the first NFL game to be postponed. More children in New York State have lost parents to COVID-19 than in the September 11th attacks, a new study finds. After pressure from Florida governor, Miami will open some schools more than 2 weeks earlier than planned. Now some short articles. Early data shows promising results from Regeneron's antibody cocktail for coronavirus. Biotechnology company Regeneron released some early results of tests using its antibody cocktail in coronavirus patients Tuesday and said it seemed to reduce levels of the virus and improve symptoms in patients. The greatest improvements were seen in patients who hadn't already mounted a natural response to the infection, the company said. The results only involved 275 patients of the 1,000 they have enrolled in this particular trial, but appear very promising. Dr. Jean Mazzaro, the director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at University of Miami, Alabama at Birmingham, told CNN. The treatment also showed positive trends at reducing medical visits for the patients, none of whom were sick enough to be hospitalized at the start of the trial, the company said. The numbers in this early release of information were small, and the data has not yet been peer-reviewed. Only top-line data was available in a news release from the company. A company spokesperson said the data validates the treatment as a therapeutic substitute for a natural response to the virus. Mazzaro said what stood out to her is that the study characterized patients by their immune responses prior to treatment and determined who did and did not benefit. What I think is fascinating is that it shows that antibodies really matter, and the antibody to the spike protein was really helpful, particularly when people made antibodies themselves, Mazzaro said. Whether it's antibody therapy or vaccine that target these proteins, it sounds like we are on the right track. I think that's really encouraging. Some U.S. communities are easing restrictions designed to stop the spread of COVID-19. Communities across the U.S. are loosening restrictions meant to curb the spread of COVID-19 ahead of a fall and winter season that experts warn could be especially challenging. Florida this week reported a spike in new cases just days after the governor cleared the way for bars and restaurants to fully reopen. In Nevada, the governor bumped the limit on public gatherings from 50 to 250 participants, though groups are still not to exceed 50% capacity of a venue. In Wyoming, which last week set a record low for new COVID-19 cases, loosened rules around restaurants after the governor said data showed dine-in restaurants have not significantly contributed to the spread of the virus in the state. And several California counties were given the green light to move into less restricted tiers of the state's reopening plans, officials said. The announcements come after the U.S. topped more than 7.1 million infections and more than 205,000 deaths, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. There's no getting back to normal, experts say. The sooner we accept that, the better. As 2020 slides into and probably infects 2021, try to take heart in one discomforting fact. things are most likely never going back to normal. It has become a well-worn phrase of our politicians, officials, experts, even family, like to lean on, an ultimate elusive prize. Perhaps it's nostalgia for the world of January, a place where daily life more closely resembled our past decades. Perhaps it's a bid to show control, to revert to a time when change was not so universally imposed upon us. But January is long gone, and it's not coming back. And psychologists will tell you that's only bad if you can't come to terms with it. We are slowly learning if this year's changes are permanent. If work, for example, of the lucky among us, will remain from home. If we will visit the grocery store less but spend more. If we will find wearing a mask on the metro to be just part of life. If shaking hands and embracing will become less common. If most of your daily interactions will occur via video conference rather than in person. 5 years change in 6 months is a common slogan for the pandemic. The disruption has upended lives and jobs lost, and relatives who live alone or perhaps died without saying the right goodbyes. Yet permanently severing ties with January is not necessarily a bad thing, psychologists say. The danger comes from hankering for normality again, rather than getting on with working out how to deal with whatever is ahead. Politicians who pretend that normal is just around the corner are fooling themselves or their followers, or perhaps both, said Thomas Davenport, the president's distinguished professor of information technology and management at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. People who suffer tragedies eventually return to their previous happiness level, Davenport said via email. But I think that COVID-19 is a little different because we keep expecting it will end soon, so there's no need to permanently change your attitudes about it. Americans over 30 have been drinking more during the pandemic, research shows. Americans over 30 have been drinking more during the coronavirus pandemic compared to this time last year, and there could be consequences to their physical and mental health, researchers reported Tuesday. Overall frequency of alcohol consumption increased by about 14% from 2019, the researchers showed in the journal JAMA Network Open. That increase averages out to about one additional drinking day per month by 75% of adults. Rand Corporation sociologist Michael Pollard and colleagues analyzed a nationally representative sample of 1,540 people ages 30 to 80. The participants completed a survey about their drinking habits between April 29th and June 9th of 2019, and then again between May 28th and June 16th of 2020. The volunteers reported they drank alcohol on more days every week. They also reported increases in the number of drinks they had, the number of heavy drinking days, and the number of alcohol-related problems over the last 30 days between 2019 and 2020. Frequency of drinking increased by 17% among women, 19% among people aged 30 to 59, and by 10% among white people. Heavy drinking among women increased by 41%, about one additional day of heavy drinking for one in every five women. Nearly 1 in 10 women, or 39%, reported an increase in alcohol-related problems, the researchers found. At times of lockdown during the COVID-19 pandemic, alcohol consumption can exacerbate health vulnerability, risk-taking behaviors, mental health issues, and violence, the World Health Organization said in April. The researchers say it's important to watch for whether the increases in alcohol consumption persist over the pandemic and whether there will be physical and mental health consequences as a result. Seven former FDA commissioners condemn White House influence on agency. Seven former commissioners of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, joined forces Tuesday to condemn increasing White House pressure on the agency they once headed. The administration pressure is eroding the faith Americans have in an agency set up to protect them from bad drugs, contaminated food, and other dangers. Doctors Robert Califf, Scott Gottlieb, Margaret Hamburg, Jane Henney, David Kessler, Mark McClellan, and Andy von Eckenbach wrote in a commentary in the Washington Post. The White House has said it might try to influence the scientific standards for vaccine approval put forward by the FDA, or block the agency from issuing further written guidance on its criteria for judging the safety and benefits of a potential COVID-19 vaccine, they wrote. On September 15th, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar revoked the FDA's authority to establish rules for food and drug safety, instead claiming that sole authority for himself, they added. This came in the wake of acknowledged acts of political influence on the FDA's coronavirus communications, significant misstatements by the secretary and other political leaders about the benefits of hydroxychloroquine and convalescent plasma, and the overruling of FDA scientists on the regulation of COVID-19 laboratory tests. At risk is the FDA's ability to make the independent, science-based decisions that are key to combating the pandemic and so much more. The former commissioners, who have served under both Democratic and Republican administrations, said the actions were undermining 114 years of work the FDA has done to build trust. If people doubt the safety of any coronavirus vaccine, they won't get immunized, the seven argued. Kessler now advises the Biden campaign. Gottlieb, who was the FDA commissioner under Trump until last year, is on the board of Pfizer, which is working on a COVID-19 vaccine. And McClellan, who served under George W. Bush, is on the board of Johnson & Johnson, also developing a coronavirus vaccine. Now we're going to move to our pre-recorded reports, and today most of these are dealing with how individuals and businesses are dealing with the effects of the pandemic where we are right now. The first three that we're going to play for you today are related more to personal reactions and things happening in their lives regarding the coronavirus pandemic. First is nearly two-thirds of U.S. households struck by COVID-19 face financial trouble. The next will be eviction crisis grows despite CDC's moratorium. And then the third is this is too much. Working moms are reaching the breaking point during the pandemic. Here are those reports.
COVID-19 has caused widespread damage to the economy, so wide it can be easy to overlook how unevenly households are suffering. This month, we've been reporting on a poll from NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And today we're digging into findings that reveal households where someone has had COVID-19 or where someone has a disability or special needs and are much more likely to be hurting financially. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports.
A young mother idles in the school pickup line, mask on, waiting for her kindergartner to get out of school in Smyrna, Tennessee, outside Nashville. Her house is getting over COVID-19.
We had to be quarantined for a while, and me and my husband didn't get paid for it.
Elizabeth didn't want to give her last name because she really needs to get back to work and worries about her job prospects. She says she's grateful that in-person school is resumed because she can't afford to sit with her daughter all day on a laptop.
We're just now, like, trying to build our family, and this has all hit at a really bad time for us, so it's been rough. It really has.
The NPR poll finds that nearly half of all Americans lost jobs or had their pay cut. But for households like Elizabeth's that have fallen ill with COVID, nearly two-thirds have less work. Health and wealth have always been intertwined. But Melinda Bunton, who chairs the Department of Health Policy at Vanderbilt University, says this polling provides some timely details.
We knew the financial hardship was more extreme, and now we can look at that intersection and say there really are groups of people who are very disproportionately affected by this pandemic.
They include households with someone who has a disability. Tiffany Butler is a mother with three boys and a foster daughter in Houston. She supports her family working for a temp agency staffing big events for conventions and pro sports games. Of course, those came to a sudden halt in March, first for 2 weeks.
Then they said a month, and then they said another month. And I was like, so am I just out of a job?
Butler says she was fortunate to have a cushion, even making just $14 an hour.
I had enough savings built up for about 3 months, and that's pretty much gone.
She's had trouble qualifying for unemployment and never received her federal stimulus money.
I was very upset about having to use savings, but I had to remind myself I put this money away for times like this.
Butler is one of around 3,500 respondents to the NPR poll, and her household is among those with a disability. More than 30% of them said their savings have been wiped out. But Harvard's Mary Gorski Findling, who helped analyze the results, says many others said they didn't have savings to start with.
So we're talking about more than, you know, half of these households just have nothing to fall back on, and it's scary.
It's becoming clear that COVID-19 is not the great equalizer some claimed in the early days. Kanika Young of the Tennessee Justice Center helps clients fight for health care and food stamp benefits.
Initially, people said that this pandemic had us all in the same boat, and others were like, no, we're not in the same boat. Some people are riding out the storm in yachts, whereas others are holding on to driftwood.
Just keeping her head above water is 20-year-old Selena Soul Singleton of Burbank, California. Singleton's dad died last year. Then when COVID hit, the film set where Singleton worked shut down. Singleton got sick, and COVID tests were in such short supply, the hospital said just assume it was COVID. But Singleton's trying to ride the unwelcome waves into something better.
I think, like, COVID, like, helped me, like, pull myself together.
Singleton decided it was time to start community college rather than following a dream to go to school in New York. And it became clear living paycheck to paycheck wouldn't cut it.
I really learned a sense of diligence with, like, saving money during this time because I just knew, like, I would need it.
But the needs keep coming. Singleton is now a few weeks into the semester at Pasadena City College and says it's still unclear how the tuition bill will get paid. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
When the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a moratorium on evictions, it warned that rising homelessness could increase coronavirus infections. It's not an abstract worry. In cities like Houston and Phoenix, landlords have been filing hundreds of eviction notices per week. Bram Sablesmith has been tracking the growing eviction crisis for Wisconsin Public Radio. He explains that COVID-19 is just one of the many health risks that come with losing your home.
Even before Robert Pettigrew learned he might get evicted, his doctor gave him some bad news.
She said, Robert, I want to talk to you and your wife. She took us to another room and she said, you have an evasive mass on your lung.
It was March. The doctor advised Pettigrew to leave his job staffing the front desk at a Motel 6 in Milwaukee. She even wrote him a doctor's note saying his lung condition put him at high risk of developing deadly complications from COVID-19.
Working at a motel is kind of hard to social distance. You know, people are in your face all times.
Now, being out of work has put Pettigrew's housing in jeopardy. The housing he needs to social distance. The home where he can rest and recover if doctors determine he needs lung surgery. In August, Pettigrew's landlord filed to evict him and his wife when they couldn't make rent. Complicating things further, Pettigrew's apartment has gotten fuller since his diagnosis. His daughter arrived in May from St. Louis after the daycare where she worked shut down. She brought her 3-year-old son with her.
This is my grandson. Say hi.
For millions of Americans like the Pettigrews, a home is a hard thing to hold on to right now. The CDC's eviction moratorium, announced earlier this month, explicitly tries to avoid housing instability. The idea is that family members should not be doubling up in housing or moving into homeless shelters right now. Emily Benford of Wake Forest University researches the link between housing and health.
These are all settings where you increase your contact with other people, and by virtue of that, you increase your risk of contracting COVID-19 and spreading that virus.
Benford says a growing body of research also links housing insecurity to other poor health outcomes, depression, delayed childhood development, and other respiratory diseases, to name a few. And the health problems can crop up even before families lose their home.
Overwhelming data demonstrates the link between the threat of eviction and anxiety and depression and stress.
Benford says the eviction moratorium is a good first step, but without additional funds for rental assistance, the order merely stalls America's eviction crisis rather than solve it. States have directed hundreds of millions of federal stimulus dollars into housing aid, but it's not enough. One estimate suggests Americans are over $21 billion behind in rent payments right now. Then there are the Americans who have already dealt with losing their homes, like Nicole McMillan. She was laid off in March from her job managing vacation rentals in Fort Myers, Florida. Soon after, she also lost her apartment where she lived with her two children.
I actually contacted a doctor. Because I thought, mentally, I can't handle this anymore. I don't know what I'm going to do or where I'm going to go. And maybe some medication can help me for a little bit, calm me down, help me focus.
But that doctor was not taking new patients. Her children are living with their fathers right now, while McMillan gets back on her feet.
I need a home for my kids again. It has ripped my whole life apart. I'm sorry. I just want my kids back. I want my life back. And I want some normalcy.
In Milwaukee, Robert Pettigrew started working odd jobs, like mowing yards or cleaning cars, work that limits his exposure to the virus, but it only brings in enough money for food. Then in August, he had a job cleaning some store windows when he saw a sign taped inside, a paper sign offering rental assistance.
The good Lord put me where I needed to be.
A local nonprofit paid his landlord directly for rent through September. He's thankful for the help, but he doesn't want pity. Life, he says, just kicks you in the butt sometimes.
But I'm the type of person, I'm going to kick life ass back.
The CDC's moratorium could help someone like Pettigrew stay in their home through December, but it's not automatic. Renters have to submit a form to their landlords, and starting in January, they may still be on the hook for all the rent payments they missed or face eviction again. For NPR News, I'm Bram Sablesmith in Wisconsin.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with WPR, Wisconsin Watch, and Kaiser Health News.
Yes, millions of kids are now back in school, but most are also still stuck at home. And that has sent many parents to the breaking point, especially moms. Women in America still shoulder the bulk of housework and caregiving in families. And for mothers who also hold down jobs, this can feel like a pressure cooker with no release. NPR's Andrea Hsu tells us more.
Yuli Lee is proud of the year she worked for the U.S. government, prosecuting cybercrime in the world's darkest places. But today, she is the one hiding out.
I just actually locked my door so that nobody could come in here, because I literally will have somebody wandering in every 15 minutes saying, like, oh, I'm on a break.
Those interlopers would be Lee's children, ages 8, 11, and 13. They're all doing school at home this fall.
Boys, where are your iPads? Do you have your iPads?
Mine is over there.
Mine is charging over there.
Okay. Parents, you know the drill.
Now you've got to get everybody online, and what does the Wi-Fi look like, and is this encrypted, and is Zoom working today?
When schools in Fairfax County, Virginia closed in March, Lee tried to work from home. She kept a grueling schedule, back-to-back work calls up to 10 hours a day, until one day she was horrified to discover that her younger kids were routinely skipping lunch.
They weren't focused on what time it was, and I think that was part of why they didn't realize, like, oh, it's time to eat lunch.
So she started skipping calls, telling coworkers she wasn't available. Then, when she heard that schools would at best only partially open in the fall, she decided to take a leave of absence.
I can't keep this up. This is too much.
See, Nicole Mason feels it too.
Yesterday, I was on a conference call. Like, a whole cat fight broke out.
Between her 10-year-old twins.
I said, excuse me, I'll be right back in a very calm voice. And I go, I'm at work. They're like, yeah, I didn't know you were at work. I was just like, what?
Mason is CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. She says the lines between work and home have collapsed.
Until we can figure out care, until we can figure out how to open the schools, you can just hang it up for women, for many women.
Of course, the pandemic's also affecting dads. But studies show moms spend nearly double the amount of time on housework and childcare. Mason says the strategy from day one should have been figuring out how to safely reopen schools so that moms like her wouldn't be getting up at 4:30 in the morning to get work done.
We just, as a country, have never really prioritized women workers. We're like, oh, well, they'll figure it out. they always do.
Take Rocio Flores, a single mom in Avondale, Pennsylvania. Flores had just started a new job at a daycare when the pandemic hit. She was grateful the daycare was even open. But going to work meant leaving her own two kids, then 7 and 12, home alone.
I had to go like every hour, you guys, okay? I told my neighbor, keep an eye on them, you know, please. That's the way I did. Going to work, scary about something could happen here.
Early in the pandemic, Flores dipped into savings to pay rent and buy food. She worried she was going to have to get a second job. And she worried her kids were learning nothing in virtual school.
It was hard, very stressful. a lot of stress.
Now her older child is still home alone doing virtual school. Her 7-year-old got a spot at a different daycare and does school from there, which is great, except that now Flores has a sprint at the end of her long work day.
Her daycare closes at 6, so I had to run, pray to God that I don't find traffic on the way so I can make it time to pick it up.
None of these struggles are new. None of these struggles are new.
Sociologist Caitlin Collins of Washington University in St. Louis says what is new is that the pandemic has made the untenable so much more visible. Now mothers and fathers of all income levels are being forced to make choices they'd rather not make, and they're realizing it's to no fault of their own.
Parents seem angry in a way that I haven't seen them in the past, and I think that that can be quite generative.
Meaning maybe all of the anger and stress and frustration people are feeling in the pandemic, maybe that will get people to mobilize to fight for policies that would bring them some relief. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Now we'll turn to the workplace. We have 4 recorded reports we're going to bring you now. The first is pandemic threatens long-term job security after hospitality industry layoffs. The next will be as pandemic stretches on, revealing possible exposure can be costly to workers. The third is airline workers face unemployment line. And the fourth and final report in this series is Disney lays off 28,000 workers, 67% are part-time employees. Here's the first of those 4 reports.
Now to another major story we've been following, the coronavirus pandemic. It's hit the hotel industry hard. Experts say it may not return to pre-pandemic strength until 2023, and 4 out of every 10 hotel employees are still out of a job. From member station WHYY, Laura Benshoff reports they face both immediate financial hardship and long-term uncertainty.
52-year-old Stephanie Swain has had pretty much the same job her whole adult life. Cook at the Warwick Hotel in Center City, Philadelphia.
I actually started in 1985 right out of high school. Then I left because I had a baby, and then I went back in 89, and I've been there ever since.
Due to the coronavirus, she lost that job in March when the hotel shut down its kitchen. So instead of getting up every morning at 3:30 a.m. for the breakfast shift, Swain is home with her adult daughter and 3 grandchildren who live with her.
Hi.
Hello. What's your name? She said, what's your name?
Otto.
During the day, they're scattered around her apartment's living room on laptops, attending virtual school, while she hangs out in her bedroom.
What's your name?
Melody.
That's a nice name.
After 6 months on unemployment and accepting food donations from a neighbor, Swain is worried. Worried that her nearly $19 an hour job, which she worked towards for 30 years, might be gone for good.
To go somewhere new, it might have to start at minimum wage. Like, I really wouldn't be able to pay my bills then. That's just so crazy to think about starting over somewhere else.
But until more people are staying in hotels, it doesn't make financial sense to rehire employees like Swain. Nationally, hotels are hovering at around 50% occupancy. In big cities, recovery is slower and occupancy even lower.
We're still at about 30, 40%.
That's Ed Groves, executive director of the Greater Philadelphia Hotel Association. He says as long as business is hurting, hotels will rely on a skeleton staff.
The folks that are bearing the brunt of this are our frontline staff, our hourly employees. I'm also very concerned that the longer that this goes on, we're going to have trouble getting some of those people back.
Hotels tend to carry a lot of debt, and many are already behind on their loans, which could lead to closures or turnover, some jobs never returning. Earlier in the pandemic, lobbyists for the industry asked for a $150 billion bailout, saying their financial picture was worse than the Great Recession and post-9/11 combined. They got some, but not all, they wanted. Dermot Dalud-Dix, a research analyst with the Union Unite here in Philadelphia, says their mostly older Black and Latino members are now facing an uphill battle to re-enter the job market.
That's a group of workers who generally find it really difficult to find a job, you know, and face racial discrimination and age discrimination in hiring.
To lessen that possibility, the union is pushing for laws called right of recall. Under those provisions, hospitality workers get first dibs on returning to their old job if a hotel reopens, rather than their job being offered to someone else or having to reapply for less pay. Such laws passed in major cities in California, and there's a push to bring them to Las Vegas and Philadelphia. Stephanie Swaim, the hotel cook in Philadelphia, would like that guarantee.
I miss getting up, going to work. I mean, I'm an early bird because I had to be there by 5:30. And now I'm up just looking at the TV because I have nowhere to go.
Without a job, she says her anxiety is high and she's not sleeping well. For NPR News, I'm Laura Benshoff in Philadelphia.
For Americans who can't work remotely, the coronavirus creates constant dilemmas. Could they catch the disease? Could they spread it without knowing? And if they're honest about a potential exposure, could they risk losing income? NPR's Camila Domonoske reports on how workers with no symptoms can face a lot of tough decisions.
When her Ford plant opened back up for production, it wasn't that Marcy didn't want to go to work. She couldn't.
I didn't have childcare, you know, when they called us back to work in late May. So I just used a week vacation until I figured things out.
Marcy didn't want to use her last name because she's worried about retribution for speaking publicly about conditions at the plant. She and another mom agreed to trade off on childcare for each other, but that carries its own risks.
I had to consider this, like, okay, I'm opening my bubble even more.
In fact, one day she learned that expanded bubble might have exposed her to the virus. She was on her shift when she found out, wondering if she should get tested.
So am I supposed to leave work? And, like, I should, because technically I could be positive and not know it, you know. But a lot of people just can't do that. Can't just get up and go, you know. We depend on the 40 hours or whatever it is a week, you know.
A big part of the problem is that she's not sure whether she'd be paid to quarantine. Marcy praises Ford's policies on masks and social distancing, but the quarantine rules?
That's a big mystery.
Ford, General Motors, and Fiat Chrysler are paying some workers to stay home and get tested, and the policies aren't always clear or consistent. Ralph Morris Jr. is the president of UAW Local 163 in Michigan.
Some of them put them on unemployment, some of them will get paid for 3 days, others will be out for 2 weeks.
And he says it's not clear what determines who gets quarantined and who doesn't.
They'll ask the question, have you been in contact with anyone? And they say, well, yeah, I was at a nursing home and they said there was a case there. And then, well, no, you got to go out.
Meanwhile, someone who says they definitely had contact with a positive case might get cleared to work. One worker at a GM plant in Michigan, who wanted to remain anonymous out of fear of retribution, told NPR she was sent home after describing a possible exposure that happened outside work, and she waited nearly a week for her negative test result without pay. Those unpaid quarantines can create an incentive for workers not to disclose all their risks if they know they might lose pay if they're honest. A GM spokesman says one factor the company considers when deciding whether to pay quarantined workers is if their exposure happened at work. Megan Garland is a labor and employment attorney at Duane Morris. She advises employers. She says exposure at work is a special case because it could be a workers' compensation issue. In some other situations, she'd advise against paying an employee to stay home.
They want to be very careful to not do something for one employee that they cannot then do for the entire workforce if it came to it.
A lot of businesses are struggling right now and can't afford to pay for all the employees who could eventually need to quarantine. She also says they don't want to create an incentive for people to exaggerate their risks so they can get paid to stay home. Still, she says, if companies can afford to pay for all quarantines.
Absolutely. This is the time to show them how much you care and that you're willing to put your money where your mouth is.
Like so many things about the virus, there's a huge divide here. For people who can work from home, quarantining while waiting for a test result is almost a non-issue. But if going to work means showing up at a plant, quarantines can create this anxious calculation, balancing the risk of spreading the disease against the risk of losing a paycheck. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Among the many things that have been radically changed by the coronavirus pandemic is the airline industry. Air travel demand is down a whopping 70% from last year, and tens of thousands of airline pilots, flight attendants, reservation agents, and other industry workers are poised to lose their paychecks next week if Congress doesn't extend federal aid for airlines. NPR's David Shaper reports.
The nation's airlines are at a crossroads, or maybe I should say cross runways. At the start of the year, on average, about 2.5 million people were flying every day. Now that's plummeted to around 700,000. And until there are widely available vaccines or treatments for COVID-19, most passengers won't be coming back anytime soon.
You can't run an airline that's a third the size it was and expect to keep all the same people.
Helene Becker is an airline industry analyst for investment bank Cowen.
I feel like in this country, we've shifted from flattening the curve to waiting for a cure or a vaccine. And that just means the pain is going to be longer.
In the CARES Act, Congress provided $25 billion of direct payroll support to the airlines so they could keep paying their employees through the end of September. Already, tens of thousands of workers have taken early retirements or other incentives to leave their jobs. But now the airlines are notifying another 75,000 that they may be out of a job October 1st.
Getting that furlough letter in the mail was a complete shock to me.
Isaiah Gonzalez is an aircraft maintenance worker for United at New York's LaGuardia Airport.
The first thing that came to mind was how I was going to support my family, the people who depend on me. How was I going to keep the income? How was I going to keep the family afloat?
And Gonzalez is not alone.
Me getting furloughed is like, it's devastating.
Tony Valentine is a reservations agent for United Airlines in Detroit.
I have six kids that depend on me.
They range in age from 2 to 22, and Valentine says that's a house full with a whole lot of bills. In addition, she says her husband suffered a serious stroke last year.
And knowing that I may not have insurance to finish this, is like, I feel like I failed.
Often at loggerheads, the unions representing these and other airline employees are now in rare harmony with airline CEOs and pressing Congress for a six-month extension of the payroll support program.
The industry's in dire straits.
Nick Callio heads the industry group Airlines for America.
At one point, passenger traffic was down 96%. It's now down 70% still. One-third of our planes are parked, not flying, and we are losing $5 billion a month.
The airlines, unions, and bipartisan majorities in Congress agree that the 6 months of payroll support worked in keeping airline employees off of unemployment rolls, and that tens of thousands of layoffs now might send shockwaves through the economy. Missouri Congressman Sam Graves is the ranking Republican on the House Transportation Committee.
We absolutely cannot let an entire sector of the economy collapse, and that's exactly what will happen if we do not get this extension done.
Yet the airline funding is tied to broader coronavirus relief that the White House and Congress cannot agree upon. Here's American Airlines CEO Doug Parker.
I just can't believe that we may not be able to do the right thing simply because our elected officials can't come to any sort of compromise agreement. We're better than that.
Still, some wonder if providing billions more in taxpayer money doesn't just put off the inevitable, as airlines will need to restructure to match the reduced demand. Legislation that would extend payroll support for the airlines was introduced in the Senate this week. But if it isn't passed soon, thousands of airline employees may be out of work 1 week from today. David Shaper, NPR News.
The Walt Disney Company is laying off 28,000 workers in the U.S. The company said the uncertainty over the pandemic left it with no other choice. Disney theme parks, resorts, and cruises, they've all been extremely hard hit. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
It wasn't for lack of trying. When Walt Disney World reopened in July, it made a video explaining safety precautions.
Prior to entering, guests will undergo a temperature screening with no-touch thermometers.
Visitors returned. Theme parks in Shanghai, Paris, and Hong Kong also reopened. But it wasn't nearly enough to make up for the losses. Disneyland in Anaheim, California has been closed for more than 6 months. In August, the Walt Disney Company reported a loss of $4.7 billion in its third quarter. In a letter to employees, Josh D'Amaro, chairman of Disney Parks Experiences and Products, writes, "We are now forced to reduce the size of our team across executive, salaried, and hourly roles." Of the 28,000 workers being laid off, 67% are part-time.
It's very distressing.
Mike Lister is a spokesperson for the city of Anaheim. He says it's been a crisis for workers, as well as the hotels and restaurants that rely on Disneyland visitors for income.
If you go down Harbor Boulevard today, which is the main thoroughfare in our city where the theme parks are, unfortunately, it feels like a ghost town.
Disney has been paying health care for tens of thousands of furloughed workers since April. In a statement, D'Amaro writes, the company is talking with employees as well as to the unions on next steps. In response, the Service Trades Council Union says it's disappointed Disney is making the layoffs. The union represents 43,000 Disney employees and says it is negotiating with the company about the news and its impact to its members. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
And as we've just heard, some companies are laying off people as the pandemic continues. Other industries are changing their strategies about how they do things. We have three reports for you. The first from the Texas Standard. Why are some ranchers now selling more beef directly to consumers? It's the pandemic. And then, coroners under pressure as pandemic brings budget cuts. And the third, companies are pivoting to selling furniture for home offices.
We are past the point of the pandemic where you couldn't find beef in your local grocery store. But the temporary scarcity created some new buying habits. After all, you can buy pretty much anything you want to online, so why not steak, right? Well, it's an option many are taking advantage of these days, and as the Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports, that could have a big impact up and down the supply chain.
Around the end of March, Chris Swenson thought he had a problem with his website. Chris is the head of Swenson Ranches, a Central Texas cattle operation that's been in his family since 1882. These days, direct-to-consumer sales are part of the business, so once a week, Chris updates what's for sale on the website.
You know, a list, you know, here's 10 sirloin steaks available, here's, you know, 50 pounds of hamburger, you know, whatever.
So he was doing that one evening, punching in all the latest inventory. But then he noticed that something was wrong. Each time he updated the site with a new item, the one he'd entered just before would go back to zero.
I'd say, oh my gosh, I must not update. I must hit the wrong button. I mean, I'm not a whiz at the internet stuff.
This kept happening until Swenson realized that the cause wasn't a glitch. It was demand.
People were waiting for us to put stuff up and were just ordering it as soon as we put stuff up.
People were desperate to buy Swenson's beef. Before the pandemic, his direct-to-consumer business was pretty slow. You might get 5 or 6 orders per week around the Austin area. Post-coronavirus, that number jumped to over 70 orders a week, and he got calls from all over.
We had a couple from Florida want to know if we would, you know, drive a whole cow over to it. can't take that much time off.
Other ranchers who sell their beef directly to consumers experience similar spikes in demand. That's because the pandemic exposed weaknesses in the beef supply chain. See, there are lots of middlemen in the beef business. When a rancher raises a cow, they typically sell it to someone else who will fatten it up. That person sells it to a meat packer, which will butcher the animal, package the beef, and then send it to the grocery store. But over 70% of U.S. beef gets processed by just 4 big companies: Tyson Foods, JBS Beef, Cargill, and National Beef. Coronavirus outbreaks among their workers forced many of their plants to close, causing a beef shortage. Customers couldn't find beef in stores, and ranchers had nowhere to sell their cattle.
But that at least opened up everybody's eyes of, like, what the heck is going on? Like, are we really this dependent on these plants?
That's Don Thilmany, a professor of agriculture and resource economics at Colorado State University. And most ranchers are that dependent on those plants. But Swenson and others like him are an exception. They typically work with small local processors to butcher their cows and then ship directly to consumers. That effectively inoculated them from the pandemic's effect on the broader beef industry.
You know, the analogy everyone always wants to use is being an independent music label versus on a big label, or a craft beer versus a large format brewery. It's just, it's almost an entirely different business model.
Selling directly to consumers isn't necessarily more profitable, but ranchers have more control over their product. That's attractive for those who want to raise specialty cattle like Wagyu or grass-fed, or are unhappy dealing with the big meatpacking companies. Ranchers have very little control over the price they get for their cows. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is currently investigating price-fixing allegations levied at the Big Four meatpackers. Still, even though the direct-to-consumer model has grown since the pandemic, it's still a very small portion of the overall beef market.
It takes a very unique and dedicated type of business person, because it's very multifaceted to do your own brand of beef, basically.
It's not easy. In addition to all the challenges that just come with raising cattle, you've also got to manage a website, do all the marketing, and get it delivered to the customer. Sure, you take the middleman out of the supply chain, but on the other hand, now you are the supply chain. Plus, getting a cow processed into cuts of beef takes special skills and equipment. Right now, the people who do that work are swamped. Josh Welsh runs a mobile processing service out of Huntsville called Pasture to Plate Processing.
I'm very busy. I'm working on average a 60 to 70 hour week.
Welsh started his business during the pandemic. He travels to customers throughout Southeast Texas, processing cattle and other animals on site. He's been successful so far, but the question is whether he and others in the beef industry who bypass big packers will be able to stay busy once the pandemic's over.
The standard processing system, as we know it, is never going to go away. But there will be a larger amount of people who will step away from it. And I think we're going to see more small processors take off.
So while the direct-to-consumer model may be more popular on the other side of the pandemic, it likely won't disrupt the entire system. But a supply chain where smaller processors working with local ranchers have more market share might be more resilient than relying on colossal packing companies. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
The pandemic has caused many kinds of work disruptions. Some people have lost work, others have more work than they can handle, and we're sorry to say that people with extra work include coroners. Colorado Public Radio's Kevin Beatty brings us this perspective from Denver.
Ryan, you got all the talks you need, I'm sure, right?
This is Dr. Jim Caruso.
I'm the chief medical examiner and coroner for the city and county of Denver, and at this present time, I am performing a postmortem examination.
Every day, Caruso and his team deal with all the things we avoid in polite society. Anyone in Denver who dies suddenly, usually outside of a doctor's care, ends up here. It's Caruso's job to determine the official cause of death, then compile numbers that shed light on trends in public health.
Our workload is up 35% from last year, which, unfortunately, in the middle of a pandemic, is problematic.
Coroners all over the U.S. say they've seen more victims of substance abuse and violent crime than usual this summer. It's thought to be an indirect result of COVID-19 lockdowns and the ensuing recession. But those forces have also caused budget cuts that impact coroners' offices, too. That can slow critical processes families need to move towards closure.
We're being told to cut our budgets, to take furloughs. I need more investigators, I need more doctors, I need more admin staff.
Caruso was able to bring on one new administrator recently.
So I'll take all of this, make sure everything's correct, and then I'll populate a death certificate.
Ian Harwick worked in another city department before he took a job helping Caruso keep up with death certificates. He had to brace himself to see death up close. But once he got past the initial shock, he realized seeing all of Denver's dead bothered him in a way he didn't expect.
It starts to paint this picture of what's not working in our city, in our state, in our society. Now I'm up close and personal with it, not working. And that's sad. Like, it definitely has changed my perception of everything.
A possible overdose, an unhoused man found in an alley. It can be hard to see so much loss at once. But he and his colleagues lean on each other. Galena Brown has worked here for more than a decade. Her job is to help families with paperwork, but she often supports her colleagues, too.
I've had people come into my office and just release, and I think that's great, and that's what we need to do, especially in this field. And sometimes we're not even aware that we need it, which is what I discovered, too. You know, the secondary trauma and grief that you carry for humanity, even.
Still, she appreciates the perspective her job offers, and she wishes more people could see Denver the way she does, that they could see how many people slip through the cracks.
It really boils down to our mental health. Is there enough access? Have we learned self-care? Have you checked in on a friend, you know, who's quarantining and also like to self-isolate already? You can ask those questions, and it shouldn't be taboo. You just throw it out there. Are you good?
Especially, she said, in this moment of stress.
Okay. See what we have.
For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beatty in Denver.
Many offices around the country are still closed while employees work from home, and that's created problems for people who sell furniture to these corporate offices. Planet Money's Greg Rosalsky says the market for desks and chairs offers a classic tale in economics.
The company iMover sells things like standing desks and treadmill desks. And when COVID hit and offices closed, it looked like doomsday.
So literally in the span of 2 weeks, all of our pipeline of orders, of bulk orders, disappeared, just vaporized.
This is iMover CEO Ron Wiener.
And we couldn't even reach people at their desks and find out what happened because they weren't there.
Wiener believed the office exodus meant a collapse in desk sales and that his company might even go under. But something completely different happened. All of a sudden, millions and millions of workers needed new desks for their home offices.
And that's why all of a sudden our sales tripled overnight. And they're still growing month to month.
iMover was well positioned for the massive shift to home offices. It's small and nimble, it sells on the internet, and its furniture is designed for easy self-assembly. The same can't be said for its bigger competitors, companies like Steelcase and Herman Miller. Those are furniture companies that got big using an old business model, selling bulk furniture that requires professional assembly through brick-and-mortar retailers. It's not a great model for the COVID home office world. Ryan Anderson, the vice president of digital innovation at Herman Miller, admits they've had to make some changes.
Well, like a lot of other industries, we face some immediate short-term challenges.
There's this concept in economics called the innovator's dilemma. The basic idea is that bigger, older companies often struggle to adapt to a changing market because all their money comes from the old way of doing things. Think the music labels and streaming music, or Kodak and digital photography. Big furniture companies like Herman Miller may have been slow to adapt to the rise of online sales and the home office market for this reason. Now, with COVID, they're being forced to catch up, adapting their old model and selling online for people's home offices.
Ergonomic desk seating, as an example, would be one of those product categories that's just been absolutely crucial right now, because there are people working from, you know, their guest bedrooms or their kitchen table, and they need a higher degree of comfort.
Anderson said he envisions a hub-and-spoke model for office work, where employees are given the flexibility to work remotely, but there's still a central office that serves as an on-demand meeting ground. There you can collaborate and bond with your colleagues or work without screaming kids. He says they're making furniture that can thrive in both settings.
I think if you're hedging all of your bets on the belief that offices will return to what they once were and that it's going to be a sea of desks where everybody needs to come and sit throughout the day to do their work, that would be very naive.
For months, Herman Miller's stock price has been in the toilet, but last week it announced earnings that showed it was now beginning to replace a huge chunk of their lost commercial office sales with home office sales. That is, it may be overcoming the innovator's dilemma. It's a bad time to be selling furniture for high-rises and office parks, but it's a great time to be selling for the home office. Greg Grzalski, NPR News.
Our final two reports today are about consumer products and the shortages of them. There are two new classifications of products that people have been having a hard time finding. The first report is the latest COVID-19 shortage is canning lids. And the next is what's behind the shortage of refrigerators and other major appliances.
Okay, we have lived through the toilet paper shortage and the hand sanitizer shortage. But right now, there is actually another shortage, one that's got some home canners on a fruitless search. NPR's Martha Ann Overland investigates.
Maybe you plant a garden every year, or maybe you started one during the pandemic, and now your garden is bursting with tomatoes and peppers and corn. But if you are dreaming of canning the fruits of your labor to get your family through the coming winter with your jars of peaches and string beans, you're probably hearing this from your local store.
Unfortunately, we all sold out of all canning stuff.
Canning jar lids?
Yeah, no, we don't have any.
Getting my hands on anything in regards to canning has been difficult lately. They just went flying.
And there's none to be had online either.
Well, it's just about everything in the canning world that you could expect.
That's Marlene Geiger of Iowa State University's Extension Service.
Jar lids are probably number one. Number two is probably jars. And then from there on, you can go to pickling spices, to pectin, even vinegar, the 5% that you need for safe pickling.
The crisis is strangely reminiscent of the great canning lid shortage of 1975. And yes, that's what they called it.
The craze to can has grown so fast.
Here's then NPR host Bob Edwards.
Demand. This critical shortage has been severely felt in the Midwest, the nation's food basket.
President Gerald Ford had encouraged Americans to plant their own gardens to offset high food costs. But when it came time to can, There were no lids.
I know where the jar lids are going.
Where are the lids?
We've given away as many as 3 bushel of cucumbers at a time. We had jars, but we couldn't get lids for them.
It makes me mad that some of these people have been canning for 40 or 50 years, and here they are, unable to get lids.
Jars can be used year after year, but lids cannot. They have a sealing compound in them that only reliably works once. Otherwise, you risk getting a nasty case of botulism. Back in 1975, angry homemakers demanded answers from their lawmakers. They phoned and wrote their congressman and President Ford. Hearings were held to investigate whether lid makers were colluding to jack up prices. The vice president of the Ball Corporation, the company that made the Ball canning jars, was called to testify. A federal investigation determined no collusion. A tin shortage the previous year, and hoarders were to blame. And manufacturers hadn't predicted the surge in home canning, just like today.
Almost every day I get a note on Instagram like, hey, I'm having a hard time finding the lids for canning jars. Do you know where I might find them? And then each time having to break the bad news to them that everyone's struggling.
Marisa McClellan, canning expert and author of the blog Food in Jars, says canners are frantic.
I'm hearing it from strangers all across the country and my mother.
Though McClellan did warn her mother early to stock up. Now with cucumbers and tomatoes starting to rot on the vine, things are getting desperate.
There's also a rise of counterfeit sites right now. Websites claiming to be Ball that are not Ball and are selling people lids that they don't ever get. So people are so desperate that there is sort of a weird faux black market that's just ripping people off.
So what began as a way for many of us to cope with the pandemic, to create a sense of self-reliance, has given way to yet another problem with another name, the Great Lid Shortage of 2020. Better make room in your freezers. Martha Ann Overland, NPR News.
Americans are used to having choices when they shop. If you need a new dishwasher, you expect to get one with your favorite features, fast. But in recent months, lots of people who need new appliances discovered they're out of luck. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
Shea Chandler did not plan to buy what seemed like the last full-sized refrigerator in all of San Antonio. When her fridge broke down Saturday afternoon a couple of weeks ago, she did what most of us would do, went to her usual hardware store, Lowe's.
All the Lowe's, all over San Antonio. San Antonio is a very large city. Everyone was out.
Chandler thought, this is nuts. All she wanted was a French door fridge with the freezer on the bottom, no dice. Her options were mini fridges or an order she would get weeks later. And then a miracle. Someone in the suburbs canceled their order. A side-by-side. Not a fridge she wanted, but a fridge she could fit.
That was the only full-size refrigerator in a 50-mile radius. That's how crazy it is. I didn't get what I wanted, but I just feel very lucky I got a fridge. I feel very lucky I got a full-size fridge.
This is happening for all kinds of appliances, dishwashers, dryers, even some of the microwaves. But it started in the spring with freezers. Here's Steve Scheinkopf, who runs Yale Appliance with stores outside Boston.
People were storing stuff because we thought this was the end of times. We needed food. We sold more freezers in 2 days than we did all of last year.
That run on freezers, and then refrigerators with freezers, set the stage for backlogs today. That's because it coincided with another factor. Makers and sellers had a hard time planning for the future. Remember, in March and April, stores shut down en masse.
We expect 400 visitors on a weekend to 3 stores, and we get 8 total.
We are in the middle of a historic recession, and so it was logical for companies to worry that shoppers would stop spending, for stores to pull back orders, for factories to scale back manufacturing. But now people are shopping, and spring was the key time to prepare for this.
If you've made the fateful decision to cancel orders in March and April, come May, June, and July, impossible to get those back.
Did you make that decision to cancel orders?
No, thank God.
You were optimistic.
Optimistic or lucky?
Not all stores got lucky with forecasts, but even more critical was what actually happened, which is waves of spikes in coronavirus cases through major hubs for shipping and manufacturing of parts and appliances. China, the U.S., Mexico. Many factories had to slow down, close altogether, or allow fewer people inside.
Factories, I think it's improved a little bit now, but I know that throughout the summer they were
operating at 25 to 50% capacity.
Sandy Tao owns AHC Appliances in Long Island. After 25 years in the industry, she has never seen such a backlog.
We have freezers that are on back order since the end of March that have still not come in.
The final twist was big demand. Turns out, when people are stuck at home, constantly reheating leftovers or baking insane amounts of bread, things start breaking. But also, when people can't splurge on trips and outings, they obsess over immediate surroundings. They